Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This variant is insubordinate, stubborn, unpredictable.
You name the god of mischief.
Unbelievable. Wherever you go, it's just death, destruction, the literal ends of worlds.
Okay. Change.
To mix it up. Is that possible? You can change?
I am Loki,
and I am burdened with glorious purpose.
Change?
Hello and welcome to the first official episode of Still Watching Loki. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us for the first time on Still Watching, what Richard and I love to do is pick a show that we're watching and hopefully other people are watching and talk about it week by week, break it down. Sometimes we talk to folks who worked on the show. We've got a great, we just finished our run on Mare of Easttown, which is really fun. So if you haven't listened to those episodes, they still exist for you, in our feed. We also had a preview episode last week where Anthony Breznican and I broke down some stuff to think about in terms of Loki. We had a long conversation with head writer Michael Waldron. That's all up in your feed as well that you can listen to. Anthony will be joining me in the back half of this episode to talk about some sort of granular comic book stuff, which is what we like to do with the Marvel shows, right, Richard? We all hands on deck for a Marvel show, right?
I come on and dribble cluelessly about what I just watched, and then you and Anthony actually explain what we just watched, which is great.
You know, and sometimes there's an interview sandwich in between. This week we have Mr. Tom Hiddleston on to talk about his long career playing Loki and some of the things that have excited him about this version of the character. So that is going to be fun. That will happen sort of halfway through this episode, and then we'll hear from Anthony. We always love getting your emails. Stillwatchingpod@gmail.com is how you can find us. We got a couple good emails this week, but like folks haven't really started watching the episodes yet, so we expect that we'll be getting more. As I mentioned in the preview episode, usually we will be recording these after you all have seen the episode, so you have time to email us. In this case and next week, we got the episodes a little early, so we are recording these early. But after that, we will be in lockstep with the rest of you. We might lose Richard to the time-space continuum at the end of the season, but we will struggle through and make it, and it will all be great. But I'm excited. Richard, is there anything you want to say about the show in general, what you knew about Loki before you started, any big questions you have about the show or anything like that?
Well, I mean, obviously I knew him from the movies, and he was such a fun breakout character and actor. And you know, I'm always a little wary of when something good in small doses is then, you know, made macro into a bigger thing.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of Loki goes a long way, but I actually think that this show figures out that balance, you know, and there's reason enough to have him as the lead of a show. You know, there's enough there in the performance and the writing, yeah. everything. So that worked well. You know, it's fun. Like, when I was a kid, we had these two big picture books, one of Greek myths and one of Norse myths. The Lairs was this.
Yes.
Book. Yeah. Yeah.
The Norse one is blue and the Greek one is yellow, right?
Exactly. Yep. And Loki was always, you know, probably a lot of little kids who were like, oh, a trickster, mischievous, like, that's my guy, you know? And so I was always sort of enamored of the idea of him. And I think that, you know, this show, because he's not the outright villain, makes better use of that kind of playful amorality, you know, which I appreciate. And, yeah, I'm curious to see where it goes. I did not know that this was going to be sort of, procedural almost, like, you know, this kind of buddy cop thing, but I'm not cop, buddy investigator. I don't know how we're going to phrase that now, but, you know, this kind of, it's following some old tropes, but, and grafting them onto the Marvel world, which is, you know, I think a fun way to do things when you have all of these characters to play with.
So we have Loki, as this episode explains, sort of popped out of the timeline at the end of the Avengers film, 2012's Avengers. So this is not the Loki that we've seen go on a, you know, journey of self-discovery and reconciliation with his brother, Thor, through the Dark World and Ragnarok and Infinity War and all of that sort of stuff. So, and, you know, he died in Infinity War. So this is an earlier, less formed Loki. And something that Michael Waldron said in our interview was that the idea that Loki had sort of, the phrase he used, which I had never heard before, was arced out, meaning like run the course of his arc. So they just, because they can, reset the arc. And here we are early on an earlier point in the arc for Loki, where he still has some emotional developing to do. And I'm excited. Thankfully, I just want to shout out the wigs really quickly. I love to talk about wigs. Loki has had some terrible hair in this series. He has kind of like a short little bob in the first one, but in Avengers, it is this like slicked back, spiky outy at the neck sort of look. And they really, and then they later gave him like a longer, curlier wig that works much better. They really skated the line between like where you pick him up in the Avengers, toss him in the desert, tousle his hair, and then like it sort of gets progressively longer. Like I was like, good job, guys. You got him to the good hair very quickly, and I appreciate that about you. So you know, Loki's already winning the wig game, which is yeah, a hard game to win.
That's important.
All right, so let's start with the setting of this world. Anthony and I talked about this a little bit on the preview episode, but the setting of this series is the TVA, the Time Variance Authority. What is your understanding, Richard, of what the Time Variance Authority is?
So it's a spinoff of the Tennessee Valley Authority, right?
Yes.
From the song.
Correct.
It's the Adjustment Bureau. Maybe
with fewer hats.
With
yes.
fewer hats.
Yes.
More Owen
wow.
Wilson.
Wow.
You know, it's some cosmic. Maybe it's a coalition of different species from across space, or maybe they kind of transcend that, or I guess, you know, maybe they were created for this purpose, but you know, it's a fun kind of thing which I feel like I've seen before, but it doesn't mean that it's like they're just repeating here, but like there's kind of all this like older analog technology like typewriters and stuff mixing with obviously stuff way beyond our comprehension, and I think that you know, in the way that Marvel has done this in the past, where you're getting a lot, you know, for the uninitiated like myself, you're getting a lot of fantastical elements and big sort of cosmic ideas and names and places and all that. And it can be a bit like alienating. And I think that to ground it with like a kind of regular seeming character like Owen Wilson's character in this really helps kind of, I don't know. It's much more inviting, I guess. And so I think that's a very clever way to do it and a really great use of Owen Wilson, who, you know, has not done a ton of on-screen stuff of late. And I think really is at a good stride in this.
Yeah, he had to be kind of convinced to do this. And I think because he's just not working like a ton right now and there are a few people who have been sort of like, so do I want to do a Marvel thing? And that's understandable. But, and something that it was interesting, a couple weeks ago when we talked to Marvel casting director Sarah Finn for one of our Falcon and the Winter Soldier episodes, she was saying that, like, I was like, oh, well, you know, Marvel's so popular now that everyone wants to be in a Marvel movie. And she's like, not quite. She was like, that wasn't true actually until WandaVision. She's like, when WandaVision hit the way that it did, and it's like, it's an awards conversation, all this sort of stuff like that. She's like, that actually opened the door wide, you know, to some things that had been previously closed. Now, Owen Wilson was already cast in this when that happened, but I was just sort of like, oh, that's interesting. That, like, I thought once you get, like, Michael Douglas and Robert Redford and, like, all these other people on board, like, no one's saying no to Marvel, but apparently they were, and maybe now they're not. So that's, you know, we'll see who they cast next.
Yeah, I wonder what the big fish are going to be. You know,
yeah.
Is Denzel Washington going to pop up in one of these things? Is Meryl Streep? I don't know.
Oh, Meryl. I mean, Glenn Close has done it. Meryl can do it. Come
exactly.
On. So that's the TVA. We get some great, I mean, it's a lot of exposition in this episode. And some of the people that I talked to who watched this episode early, you know, like TV critics who are critical for a living, thought the pacing was a little slower than they expected. Someone used the word sluggish, and I can cut my first time through, I was kind of like, oh, this is a little slower than I expected. And there's a lot of exposition lift that they have to do in this first episode. But once I started rewatching the episodes, and I'm embarrassed to say how many times I've rewatched them by now, I didn't have any pacing questions or issues. And I think the amount of exposition they do, either via Owen Wilson's character of Mobius or the animated character Miss Minutes, voiced by legendary animation voice actress Tara Strong, that's just some clever, fun stuff to dump a bunch of sci-fi rules and regulations on our laps, right?
Yeah, there's a ton they have to establish, you know, and so the introductory episode, sure, it's revving up for the bulk of the season, and it's not giving that kind of, like, big bang at the beginning that maybe people hope for, which, you know, could be proved a little bit tricky for Disney because they are doing this week to week. It's always fun to watch a world be built when it's done with kind of wit and invention. And I know that all of these, or most of these things existed in the comics before, but it's new to me. It's going to be new to a lot of people. And it feels like they have a good idea, which is kind of leading me to ask you about Michael Waldron, because he is the creator of the show, the writer of, I think, many episodes, if not all. And he's what, 34? So he's a lot older than us, you and I.
Ancient.
But he's still pretty young and, like, seems to have kind of rocketed out of nowhere and is now doing multiverse and doing Star Wars for Feige, you know, right? Like, so tell me a little bit about him, because you wrote an article about him.
Yeah, we did a nice little feature on him last week. And he's a Rick and Morty writer. And, like, Rick and Morty is a show that I really love outside of its fandom, which can be kind of toxic sometimes. But he's a Dan Harmon guy, and Feige, Kevin Feige at Marvel has proven that he really loves picking up Dan Harmon people. The Russos were directors on the TV show Community. That's their Dan Harmon people. Jeff Loveness, who's writing the new Ant-Man film, is a Rick and Morty writer. Michael Waldron, Rick and Morty writer. Jessica Gao, I believe, who's running She-Hulk, is Rick and Morty writer. Right. So, like, that's the vibe that obviously Kevin Feige wants in his stuff going forward. And I think you can see a lot of the Rick and Morty DNA in this, in terms of, like, irreverent fun with sci-fi tropes. Don't get burdened by rules. Poke fun at your own rules. Have fun. That's sort of the vibe that's going on here. And Waldron, I mean, we've talked before about what it takes to work at Marvel, right? Like, as a creative, there have been some creatives where there's been some friction, like Edgar Wright left because he couldn't make exactly the Ant-Man that he wanted to make. Because at this point in Marvel, you're sort of like a thread in a tapestry rather than an auteur. And I think Waldron, my understanding, talking to Dan Harmon and some other people who worked with him, is that he is, like, he's a team player. You have to be a team player at Marvel, right? So he's, like, a creative, inventive guy, good writer, and a team player. And all of those things are exactly sort of what it takes to get along at Marvel. So That's what I would say. But yeah, 34, and it's just one thing after another going on for Michael Waldron. And he seems, like, I talked to him for several hours over Zoom, seems genuinely just, like, a nice, cool guy. So that's all, you know, you'll love to see it.
And Kate Herron, who directed the episode, is also a kind of new up-and-comer, I believe, from the UK.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's nice to see a kind of, it's fun to see a sort of younger talent pool being brought into this world. Hopefully not swallowed up by it, you know? They can enter it, have some fun, and then do their own other things if they want. Or if they want to stay, they can stay.
Kate directed some of Sex Education, which is a great show. I love that show on Netflix. And she will be talking to us later in the season. I'm really excited to talk to her. But she gave a great interview to the Empire Magazine podcast where she talked about how she got the gig. And basically, like, she was up against a lot more seasoned directors, but she is just a huge Loki fan, and so she just wrote this massive pitch you know, based almost entirely on her ardent love for Loki. But she's also just a huge, you know, and I say this, I can call her this from inside the club, like, a huge nerd. She's a Buffy fan, she's a Lost fan, she's like, you know, this is who she is. She's very comfortable in this world. And the thing that we've discovered about these Marvel shows is that, you know, in other shows you talk about showrunners, creator, sort of stuff like that. With these Marvel shows, it's been these, like, sort of two-handers where you've got a head writer, in this case Michael Waldron, and a director, in this case Kate Herron. Like, in WandaVision it was Jack Schaefer and Matt Shackman, right? And so and in this case it's even more slightly complicated because Waldron, like, got popped out to go work on Doctor Strange while Loki was shooting, so Eric Martin, who's one of his writers, became sort of like the writer on set. But that's sort of the creative stew. And I think it's a really, really fun mix. And they've created something really, like, fresh and exciting. And I think another big part of that is that Waldron is not a comic book guy. And sometimes it takes a not comic book guy, like, looking at the story from outside the years and years and years of continuity to give us an entry point as welcoming as Loki is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, exactly. Yeah, you need to have the sort of fresh eyes on it. And I think something I really appreciate about, you know, this first episode is that it has a real point of view. It feels, I mean, this is such a trite word to say in general, but especially about something from this huge corporate entity, but it feels sort of like a more artisanal than just kind of product, you know? There's a sort of care to its design, and there's a wit and a level of kind of erudition in the script that, you know, I am waiting to hate some Marvel thing, because it's going to happen at some point. But, like, they kind of keep, for the most part, finding ways to make things accessible and new and clever that. You know, and I think a lot of that does have to do with that sort of outside talent, you know, because they know what other people in the world want, versus just doing the, like, well, this is what the comic books did, and then we just have to kind of literalize that on screen.
Right. The other, I completely agree with you. The other creative that I want to shout out is Kasra Farahani, who is the production designer, because the production design of the TVA is just incredible. Like, I never want, like, you know, sometimes people send us, like, stuff that's, like, branded from a TV show or a film, and I'm usually like, okay. And I have a ton of notepads from various shows, but I'm dying for a TVA notepad. Like, I want that logo on the top of a notepad that I can write on. But and Waldron, you know, offered up a bunch of different inspirations for this show, but Mad Men is his favorite show. And he also referenced Catch Me If You Can, which I rewatched last week after he mentioned it, as like, you know, if you think of Owen Wilson in the Tom Hanks role and Tom Hiddleston in the Leonardo DiCaprio role, this sort of, like, cat and mouse, but also vaguely, like, I think the word Tom Hiddleston uses, avuncular relationship between Mobius and Loki, like, but that 60s vibe is obviously, like, something that's very interesting to Waldron, and very, very much on every frame here. So there we go. So we got the TVA. We've got Mobius and Loki, played by Owen Wilson and Tom Hiddleston. Let's talk about who else is at the TVA. We've got a judge named Renslayer, Ravonna Renslayer, Lele Gugu Mbatha-Raw. You know, she only has really one scene in this episode, but what did you think of having her here?
Well, she's always welcome. I like her in things, you know. And again, lending this sort of weary human element to this fantastical thing helps ground us. And, you know, she plays well in that world, as does Wunmi Masaku, who plays one of these, the head kind of time cops.
Time Cop, a movie I also recently watched for the first time. Hunter B-15 is her official character name.
Okay.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, she's a great actor. She was on Lovecraft Country most recently, and a Netflix horror movie called His House, which she's fantastic in. So, yeah, I mean, like, it seems well-populated so far. Eugene Cordero is in there. And but, you know, you always wonder with these shows, like, they get these great actors, like, how much are they going to be used? So I'm curious to see who's going to emerge as, like, the main players in this ensemble.
I was interested to see that Eugene Cordero and Tara Strong, who voiced Miss Minutes, Tara Strong, I should say, the reason she's a legendary voice actress is she's, like, she did Harley Quinn. Like, that's her big, like, thing. But she's done a bunch of other stuff.
Before Kaylee Cuoco took over.
Yeah, yeah. Before Kaylee and before Margot Robbie. Like Wunmi Masako and Gugu being in the credits, I was prepared for, but Eugene Cordero's in the credits. I was like, are we going to see his character Casey like a lot? That would be interesting. And I think this show also owes some favors to The Good Place for this sort of like admin afterlife vibe that they're going for here, which is not, you know, there's no shame in that. That's a good thing to borrow from. But thinking of Eugene Cordero, who a lot of us got to know from The Good Place, it's fun to see him here. So Loki grabs the Tesseract. We see that scene from Endgame where he leaves. And it's, you know, of course, it's fun that these Marvel shows get to like port in scenes. So you get Anthony Hopkins and Robert Downey Jr. showing up in the premiere of your TV show. Not too shabby, right? He ports out of there with the Tesseract. He lands in the Gobi Desert. Quickly apprehended, brought into the TVA, put through all these hoops, all this exposition dumped on him, great reaction comedy from Tom Hiddleston. And then he has his trial, and then he has this conversation with Mobius. But I think sort of the most interesting thing, and we'll circle back on some of that stuff, but the most interesting thing that happens is when he escapes yet again, is running around the TVA, and he finds this drawer full of Infinity Stones that are just treated as like nothing, as paperweights. And one of the questions Michael Waldron said that, you know, they were grappling with was like, it's sort of like, how do you keep something interesting after Thanos? Like, after Thanos, mm-hmm. which is so big, how do you make a, you know, monster of the week or whatever sort of story interesting? And the way you do it is to make it so, to make what Thanos was chasing after with all his might for, you know, an entire film, nothing, a plaything to these people.
It's the alien playing with the marble at the end of Men in Black. You know, correct. It's just kind of like there's always something bigger, which is one of the great kind of boggling mysteries of the universe. We only know, you know, I'm in my house and outside the street, and then the city, then the country, the state, the country. You know, is there anything other than outside the universe? You know, and to then kind of zoom out and be like, oh, just those paperweight things. Like, sure, whatever. It has a kind of dual purpose where it's funny and puts us in a new context, but also like is a huge like existential crisis moment for Loki, because he's like, wait, but what? I'm actually kind of minor in the order of the universe. That's not how he's used to thinking of himself.
Right, he's a god, and then he's like, oh no, I thought, you know, he was treating the Tesseract as if it were this precious item. Tesseract, also Infinity Stone. But, like, it's nothing to these people. They don't care. And I thought that was so smart. Like, such a clever moment. Stakes-setting moment, I guess, of everything. And then let's talk about the rules of the time variance authority and sort of what... So there's this sacred timeline that these three shadowy figures, the timekeepers, at some point in the distant future... have decided is the correct timeline to keep things tidy, to keep multiverses from going to war with each other. And they will prune any branching timeline in order to make sure that sacred timeline stays solid. And you see this great visualization of it. You get this visualization of it in the field, like when a branch is approaching the red line and there's a time and we set off these reset charges, I think they're called in the comics. I think they're called retcons, which is funny, but like they're mm-hmm. called reset charges here. And basically everything that happened in that branching timeline gets obliterated and reset. Does all of that stuff make sense to you? Does it feel like gobbledygook in any way, or does it feel just like really clear?
Well, I mean, questions of, like, time travel always have these paradoxes attached to them, you know, and I think the big one for me right now is, like, okay, so if Loki jumps out of the 2012 Avengers timeline, how does that not then negate everything that happened after that, you know? And I guess because it's time, they can just, once this is all done, they can kind of close the little loop and just put him back in, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess they can kind of get away with it that way because this is happening out of time as well as in time. So, you know, there's some head scratchy stuff in there, but, I think the show is both explaining enough and also leaving enough ambiguous that you kind of are fine with it. I mean, what I'd be curious about is whether these three all powerful beings, how sinister or benevolent mm-hmm. they're going to kind of ultimately be made to seem, and maybe who's playing them if they're going to show up corporally, because it's a sinister idea, though it's also an idea that is the tenet of like a lot of major religions in the world, you know, that like there is a master plan, that it's all sort of being preordained in some ways, and that, where does free will come in and all that. So I would kind of think that given the Marvel Universe's take on some of those questions about power and whatnot, that they will definitely be wrestling with that while also maintaining this kind of closer story about Loki.
Yeah, it's interesting. This idea of predetermined fate, right? That the timekeepers have decided what the sacred timeline is. I do still have questions about it, and I'm hoping like, oh, please send us an email, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, if you have a firmer grasp of whether or not, like, if there's a branch, because there's these Loki's not the only Loki variant, right? They call him a variant. So my understanding is, in stepping out of the timeline there, he's created a branching reality, but, like, the main reality still happens.
Oh, right, because it's multiverse. So
it's a multiverse.
Multiple things can happen at once, right?
So there's two Lokis that look like Tom Hiddleston now, right? There's the one that goes through and does all the Ragnarok, and then there's this one.
Even though the Loki in 2012 did seem to disappear.
I know. I hear you. But that's like also a timeline loop, right? Because like the Avengers went back in time. So I don't know. Right. Maybe I'm wrong about this. And if you guys have better answers, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I do know that the Loki writer's room were very concerned that these branching timelines make sense, right? Because I think they fudged it a bit in Avengers Endgame when Steve Rogers just sort of like went back in time and we didn't really talk about all the ramifications of that.
As you mentioned, the Doctor Strange movie coming up, written by the same person, mm-hmm. is called Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. So I don't think we're going to get a closed kind of, you know, tidy little ending to this, because it's probably going to keep barreling on into the next phase of all this stuff.
And they even use the word madness when describing in the sort of like Miss Minutes exposition. I think she says something about like the timekeepers did this. She said, oh, yeah. So when someone steps off the timeline, a variant, they create a nexus event, which if left unchecked could branch into madness. So. Multiverse of Madness. Get excited. Nexus event is something we talked about in WandaVision. A nexus being... Sorry to get so weedsy in this part of the podcast, but do you remember that there was like this... One of the commercials in WandaVision was about like a, you know, an antidepressant called Nexus or something like that. And and that Wanda's a nexus being, which means like she exists the same across all branching realities. She's still always Wanda. Whereas like Loki might look different in different branching realities. So, yeah, that's another way it could connect to Doctor Strange, potentially. Let's talk. So the reason that Mobius is interested in this Loki variant is because he's tracking another Loki variant, a very dangerous one, who is hopping around time, stabbing the timekeeper, they're called Minutemen, the hunters, right? Stabbing them and stealing their reset charges. So we see this crime scene in France, in this church in France, which, as you say, like procedural, like this feels like a classic sort of crime scene moment out of a different show, with Mobius playing the head detective.
And it feels like the pilot episode for the recruit, you know, the recruitment, the new person. So we explain all this stuff and then like, okay, now we're off to solve cases, you know, like it, again, it's familiar, but like it's a tried and true setup because it's a reliable one, you know, and it can be fun. Especially when it's so far removed from all of the actual real world problems about law enforcement and all that.
Yeah. I saw someone reference Mindhunter as like something that they thought of when they watched this. And I was like, that's a bit overblown. And then I thought about it and I was like, well, you know, the premise of Mindhunter is that they're interviewing these various serial killers to try to understand and catch other serial killers. Right. And the ending of Catch Me If You Can, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Frank Abagnale Jr., gets brought into the FBI to catch other forgers. He's the expert forger who can catch forgers for them. So, like, they're bringing Loki in as the Loki expert to catch another Loki is the premise of the show, which I think is really smart, really fun.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a show about, like, identity and who you are. Loki is confronted with all this footage from these other Loki movies. You see him in Ragnarok. He sees his own future journey, his own development. He has a real crisis of identity while he's watching that. Like, who am I? Who am I that I can see a future where I'm in this beautiful place with my brother? Like, who am I? And then what better to answer that question than to show him a mirror of himself in another variant, you know, which I think is really fun. And that, I mean, that's the, like, the show wants to be as much about that emotional psychoanalyst sort of stuff as it does about fun sci-fi time hopping. All right, so let me bring up a show that you recently got into that I really want to talk to you about in terms of how it relates to this show, which is Richard Lawson. You're watching Doctor Who for the first time, I think.
Yes, the person I live with is a big fan of that show, and he kind of
I love this
dove back into the I don't know what it was. It wasn't a reboot exactly, but with the Eccleston, you know, the Russell T. Davies.
They call
iteration.
It New Who.
New Who.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, it's long been a big cultural blind spot for me, often referenced by many people I know. It's a much more engaging show than I thought it would be. You know, it has a sort of melancholy about time travel and about this character who is just kind of endless and, has been everywhere, seen everything, been every time. You know, and there's a weariness there that I wasn't expecting. And Billie Piper, who, you know, has gone on to become a really, I mean, she's great in the show, but like a very like well established, respected actor here in the UK. So I like the vibe that Loki is giving off so far, where it's that same kind of like sardonic, you know, omnipotent or, you know, omniscient anyway, being in Owen Wilson's character, recruiting someone new to like, not travel with in the way that Doctor Who does, but like to explore and solve. And I like that setup. And I think it's like Star Trek, but you know, but also messier and sort of scrappier and more individual. I would have to imagine that there are some conscious parallels being drawn there between those two shows, between Loki and Doctor Who.
I think the constant elevator travel in this, is, you know, it's a little Bill and Ted, but I think it's also a little Doctor Who. And yeah, absolutely. I think Doctor Who is a vibe here. I have to imagine that Kate Herron, being a British nerd, is a Doctor Who aficionado. I'm a huge, like, the New Who, which is starts with a Christopher Eccleston, who's the ninth actor to play the Doctor, is the Russell T. Davies seasons, which is just Eccleston and David Tennant are among my favorite of television ever, and I rewatch them all the time. I think it's, you know, some episodes are way better than others, but like when it's good, it's just like some of the best sci-fi TV you've ever seen in your life. And then, you know, and then it's sort of hit and miss for me when Stephen Moffat and Matt Smith and Peter Capaldi and other people take over. But that is the Shining era for me. And I do see a lot of its DNA all over this. Something that Neil Gaiman once said when I went to a convention and watched Neil Gaiman talked about Doctor Who, because that's who I am, is that, you know, it's just that Doctor Who is the simplest thing to explain, because it's essentially a children's show. It's the simplest thing in the world to explain to a new person. You don't have to have seen decades and decades and decades of Doctor Who. You can just say, like, here's a man and his box. It travels through time and space, and he's here to help. Like, that's it. Madman in a box. It's a really simple premise, but has so many permutations, and but doesn't get bogged down in you needing to know a lot. And I think Loki is aiming for a similar thing, where, like, if you've seen Loki in the MCU, great. But like WandaVision, if you're coming in kind of fresh, I think you can just hop on board Loki and have a good time. So that's great news. One thing I want to make sure that we hit before we go here in sort of the, like, for the newcomer section, is the D.B. Cooper moment. Yeah. What did you think of that, Richard?
I thought it was fun. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, Waldron being a fan of Mad Men, there was a long fan theory that Don Draper / Dick Whitman, right, was D.B. Cooper. Obviously, he wasn't. So that's a fun little thing about, like, okay, TVA, you guys travel through time, but I sort of have been around doing shit too. And I hope that there's more of those little, like, what else was Loki up to, you know, throughout his long life.
If you're unsure about D.B. Cooper, there is a documentary, an HBO film that came out last year about D.B. Cooper. Also, our colleague Julie Miller has a great write-up on VF.com titled Nearly 50 Years Later, The Mystery of D.B. Cooper Remains an Obsession. But basically, this is a guy who robbed an airline and then skydove out of the plane and was never found. So it remains a mystery. This is an opportunity that Loki has to, like, play with some of these, like, unsolved mysteries and urban legends and whatever of history. It can go anywhere in time, and that's always fun. I love time travel shows. Like, two of my favorite shows growing up were, like, Highlander and Quantum Leap. Like, I'm a big let's hop around time TV show fan. So this is very much up my alley. And the fact that it is coupled with this sort of identity crisis story, which is very Mad Men, right? Because, like, Don Draper / Dick Whitman, like, a big question for him is, who am I? Can I remake myself a man? What kind of man is that? All tied up in this idea of, like, packaging in you know, the advertising industry. So that's a really interesting kernel for this story. So I'm excited. Like, this is just so up my alley. I'm thrilled. Anything else we want to hit on before we go talk to Tom Hiddleston, Richard?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that you know, it was interesting that a little bit of pathos was introduced with, like, what would it be like to see your own death, you know?
Yeah.
And to consider the fact that, like, you know, how does anything matter? And I'll, you know, talking about the kind of melancholy in Doctor Who, like, I'll be curious to see where that little thread that's been sort of introduced here is woven throughout everything else, because there's obviously a lot of humor in this and, you know, adventure. But this episode, you know, while yes, maybe it's a little exposition heavy, it's setting up a lot of interesting plate spinning. And I feel excited about it in a way that I felt, you know, excited about WandaVision. So, yeah, I'm happy that, I mean, it's crazy that these things have been released 1, 2, 3 in a row, you know, and not more meted out. But I guess that means that Marvel has a lot other stuff to come.
More to come. I guess the last thing I want to talk about with you, because I did talk to Tom Hiddleston about this, is this idea that, like, Loki in the comics is, because he is, you know, the show opens with that moment from Endgame where we see Loki turn into Captain America, right? And it's just a nice little reminder that, like, Loki's magic, which is illusion based, has a lot to do with his ability to, like, shapeshift, you know. So if we're having questions about identity, this idea of, like, shapeshift magic, of course, is, like, a really interesting idea. And because in the comics Loki can shapeshift or reincarnate and all this various stuff, like, he has been a kid in the comic. There's the character called Kid Loki. He's been a woman in the comics. There's a character called Lady Loki. All this sort of stuff. He was a character called Eikel, which is just Loki backwards. Like, there's all these various, like, permutations of who Loki has been. And because of that, like, gender, age, jumping identity around Loki, and I think Hiddleston said this even reaches back to some of the Norse stuff, Loki is sort of like this pansexual, queer character, canonically, for people, and you know, for all people, because it's canon. And so I was just wondering, like, if you have any thoughts about Loki being in that position.
Well, we'll see how thoroughly they get into it, if they get into it, you know. There has obviously been some frustration with other Disney properties that say, oh, there's a queer person in this, right, or non-binary, and then it's like they're in two scenes or one scene, or, you know, in the case of Cruella, like, introduced and sort of hinted at being non-binary or queer or whatever, and then they just become another functionary of the, you know, of the story, and, you know, so,
yeah.
I hope it's, if it's going to be introduced, I hope it's done so thoroughly, you know, because otherwise I think sometimes trying to get praise for, like, a little bit of scrap thrown at people, it's not worth the trouble.
Totally. And you know, to be clear, the Loki creators are not saying, we can't wait for this exclusively queer moment that you're going to see in our show. Yeah. They're not promising anything, but this is an expectation or a hope, I think, that the fans have. So, you know, we'll see. And I think Tom Hiddleston gave a nice answer around this. You know, so without promising anything. But I think if you're exploring the identity of someone who can be gender fluid, and something we should say, someone noticed that in promo material for the show, there's Loki's file, and under gender, it says fluid. So, you know, they're right, at least, yeah, like, mm-hmm, somewhat engaging with this, if maybe extremely lightly, because it's Disney and Marvel. So we'll see. We'll keep our eye on it.
And codifying that term in the Marvel universe, which I think it's a small thing, but it means that they're establishing it as, like, as at least these time people or time entities are right, conscious of those variances. So
I guess, I know I said that was the last thing, but one last thing really quickly for you, Richard, which is that there's some stuff we can't talk about because we've seen episode two, you know.
Yeah.
But we should say that, you know, they are laying out a mystery here. We're hunting someone. We've got a crime scene in France. We've got a crime scene in Oklahoma, at various points in time. You know, there's clues being dropped. Once again, it's hard for us to talk about since we've seen the next episode. But I don't know. Is there anything you want to say about? I mean, is this a theory show? That's the question. Do you know what I mean? We had a lot of fun with weird theories around WandaVision. Like, does it feel like a theory show?
I think so. I mean, I did see some, again, I don't remember if it was you, it probably was, about how they're really going to try to have this be, like, contained episodes so people can be like, oh, that episode of Loki versus just kind of experiencing it as, like, a serialized movie or whatever.
Right.
So I think things that if things are introduced and resolved by the end of the episode, there probably will lend itself a little bit less to theorizing. But I, again, with the Time Lords or whatever, like that stuff, that might be the overarching theory stuff. And then each discrete episode will have a kind of conclusion, which I like. That's a good model to follow, I think.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, let us get into our interview with the great Tom Hiddleston.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, Joanna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Is it morning? Is it morning where you are? Is it afternoon?
It is morning. It's 9 in the morning here. So
it's not too unearthly.
No. We are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed over here. Thank you. I wanted to start by asking you something that I asked your head writer as well, which was, you know, what you consider in the films, what you consider the most important Loki moment that will help people understand Loki in this show?
Sorry for the long pause. It's just such a good question. And now I'm kind of cycling through them. There are so many. You mean for me personally or for the beginning of the series?
For you personally, I think maybe just to who you think, what's a foundational Loki moment? Is it the Odin confrontation in the first Thor film? Is it, you know?
I was going to say that. Yes. For me, it was a doorway into the character's vulnerability, which sits underneath all the other many layers that the character has. As a shapeshifter, he's somebody who wears so many masks and has such a mercurial dexterity that he can present many different faces. He can be charming and charismatic and playful. He can be quite threatening and manipulative. He has very, very useful powers of persuasion. He can be physically imposing. He can be warm and inviting, but underneath it is I think a very a fractured sense of self, a confusion about who he really is, and a sense of being perhaps a sense of not quite belonging. And that becomes, you know, for me, it became a real cornerstone in the characterization that could take him off in lots of different directions, but perhaps the audience had been allowed to see Loki's vulnerability. My eternal thanks to Don Payne, who wrote that first film, and Kenneth Branagh and Anthony Hopkins, all part of it, hugely part of that moment. And then in terms of connecting with Michael Waldron, we talked about it a lot as if that moment raises the question within Loki's mind, who am I? In fact, if my memory serves, he turns around and says to Odin, what am I? And those questions are questions we're still answering 10 years later in the series.
One of our best ways of understanding who Loki is as a reflection of Thor through his relationship with Thor, right? This brotherly dynamic, this love relationship, that there are differences, there are similarities. What is it like for you to approach a story without Thor there as a reflection of your character?
But first of all, apologies if you can hear a very active fly.
I can't, but I'm so sorry. Oh, I see it. I do see it though.
Okay. Just sort of, you know, in case there's a slightly awkward buzzing in your headphones. Anyway, you're a welcome addition to the interview, sir, but perhaps we can make yourself scarce. Great question. Chris and I defined Thor and Loki at the same time for the first time together. And these two brothers who were polar opposites and defined by that opposition. We talked about, I remember back in the day, we talked about Thor and his particular athleticism that he would use Mjolnir, the hammer, like a heavyweight boxer. And the stunt department, amazing stunt department on that first film, kind of together we invented a kind of choreographic style for Loki that if Thor was grounded and like a block of granite, Loki was like the wind kind of dancing around him. And that was some in the past, in the childhood, that they've been a team, they've been a good team. But this would be a really interesting way of exploring their kind of oppositional characteristics. And for a long time, there was no Loki without Thor. And I think both characters emerged in that reflection. But what I loved as well is that I hope with paying respect to that relationship, and that relationship stands alone and has its integrity, taking Loki out of a context which is familiar has been really interesting. Thor is nowhere to be seen. Asgard is very far away. There are no Avengers near at hand. He's even stripped of his status and his power. And then it becomes an interesting question of what is left. If you strip Loki of all the things that are familiar to him, what remains? And that's for him to discover as much as the audience.
I was going to ask you about that because, yeah, you know, he loses the costume we're familiar with, the daggers. He can't do magic, at least at the TVA, all of that. And it reminded me a lot of what they did for Chris as Thor and Ragnarok, right? They strip all this stuff away. And so then you get to really explore what is at the core of this character without those trappings, right?
That's really interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting. Interesting comparison.
But at least he had Loki and Hulk there. And you are, I think, the most isolated a Marvel character has been in his own adventure going forward.
Yes, that's very possible. I'd have to do a deep dive and, you know, isolated characters in the MCU, discuss. And certainly in Ragnarok, I think for Chris, it was a really exciting avenue to explore. We all remember what happened in that film. The hammer, Mjolnir, is destroyed very early on. He feels he doesn't know who he is without it. And he's away from home, away from Asgard, and gets his hair cut. But what I loved, I remember when I watched it for the first time, I was so delighted by this idea, which is that somehow Thor's power was something that resided within him and had been the whole time. But he'd externally kind of located it in these objects, but really it was something that was inside him. I thought that was really, really cool. In a very colorful and spectacular movie.
Well, thankfully Loki gets to keep his hair, so we're all grateful for that. I want to ask you about, well, then, stripped of these relationships, a foundational relationship for Loki in this series appears to be the one that he's forging with Mobius, with Owen Wilson's character. Yeah. And something that that Michael Waldron said to me is that a primer sort of for some of the stuff in this show for him was the film Catch Me If You Can, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And there's this interesting, almost father-son, but antagonistic dynamic between Tom Hanks's character and DiCaprio's character. And I couldn't help but sort of think of that as I was watching these episodes we've seen. How do you think of the Mobius-Loki relationship, at least in these early days? And does that comparison strike you?
Wow. I love the relationship, first of all, between Mobius and Loki. And the thing that was so new and fresh for me was that Mobius is a character who is emotionally detached from Loki's emotional turmoil. And all the tricks that Loki tries to play, and they usually work on everybody else, skills of provocation or manipulation, it just don't land with Mobius. But he's also kind of delighted to be there and has an academic curiosity about having Loki in front of him. And so Loki is on the back foot and has to rethink how to talk to Mobius and interact with him. But they're both very clever and both trying to outsmart each other, and realize very, very early on that they need each other for different reasons. And that's a feeling that's unusual, and that in needing each other, they might have to try to trust each other, which is going to be very difficult. and in a way, maybe it's because there's some similarity there. And I think what I loved in my conversation with Owen about this was that, you know, Mobius is an analyst within the TVA. He has a particular job to do, but that he has a playfulness in him that's that's perhaps a part of it, just a part of who he is, that maybe is mirrored by Loki's playfulness and an independence of spirit, which perhaps Mobius isn't even aware of is different from the TVA's institutional identity. So there's a kinship there, which perhaps is interesting because they're not aware of it themselves, at least initially. And I remember Michael talking about Catch Me If You Can, which I also agree with you is a terrific film, with great performances from those two. And I suppose it is a good it's a good parallel, because Tom Hanks has got to catch him in the end. There's a sort of respect and a kind of whether it's fatherly or avuncular, there is this sort of somehow some empathy involved in the endeavor, which is touching and unusual.
But speaking of that fatherly sort of avuncular mode, that's what I felt when you have this moment where Loki says, "I'm very smart," and Mobius says, "I know you are." And that was such like it's funny, but it's also just a very healing moment, because Loki has been trying so hard to get people, his father, whoever, to acknowledge his value. And here's someone who's just sort of like, oh, as a matter of course, like, yes, I know you're very smart. I know you have value. I'm aware.
It's really destabilizing for Loki, because no one's ever said that. And Loki finds himself in the presence of someone who is confronting him with who he is, who he might be, seemingly without judgment, without any particular take or castigation or punishment. And that's so unusual for, I think he's used to people punishing him and condemning him and judging him. And here is this very even tempered man agreeing with him, and it's a really new feeling for Loki.
Yeah.
So it challenges Loki's first instincts to be resistant. But Loki's so provocative, he's so constantly resistant, and Mobius is there saying, listen, there's nothing to resist. I'm here. I know. And I love that about the dynamic.
Something I was revisiting some of your old interviews, and something that I thought was really interesting that you were talking about in the original Thor film, that there was some anxiety around, okay, we've done Iron Man. He's very grounded. Now we're going to go to space and do Norse gods. That's what we're going to do. And there was some anxiety about, will this land with audiences and that sort of thing. We have seen time travel before in the MCU, but this is also a big swing in terms of, here's the TVA, here's this big new sort of world-breaking, world-reframing idea. The Infinity Stones are marbles to these people, like all of that sort of stuff. Did it spark an old familiar feeling of, here we go again, launching something new and exciting for the MCU?
I was so excited by the idea, because the TVA represent order and Loki represents chaos, and order versus chaos is always a great place to start. Mm-hmm. And I thought if we can kind of take Loki and have him behave in the way that only Loki would in such an environment, it just was it afforded so many new opportunities for the story, which I found very exciting. There was a lot of head scratching we had to do at the same time about making sure we checked in with each other about the rules of the TVA, because when creating another world, it has to have an integrity, it has to have a kind of its own internal logic. But I have a huge trust in Marvel Studios. There's, you know, the great secret to my mind of how they work over there is they have some highly intelligent people who work extremely hard. They were very aware of the kind of the diligence and conscientiousness that they required. But also I'd seen them work hard and for the ideas to sing before. So perhaps I had a lot of trust in them.
One thing that I think is so interesting about Loki and what he means to a fandom is that in the comics, he has this gender fluid, pansexual, queer identity that is important to a lot of his comics fans. And I was just wondering what your feelings are around that aspect of Loki.
I was have always been aware of it, mm-hmm. and see it as my responsibility as somebody who, you know, is able to portray this character at this time, that I honor the aspects of the character which are there in the canon. And it was important to Kate as well, and important to Michael. And it seemed that I remember even back when I was first cast and I went back to the comics and all the publishing that Marvel have been, you know, they've been making for 60 years now. Is that right? About that. And I was aware within the comics of the extraordinary range within his identity, and the fluidity in lots of areas. And then if you look at the history of the character in, you know, the collective consciousness in thought for hundreds and thousands of years, Loki has been a character that is very difficult to restrict or limit. And there's the whole point of Loki is that Loki is a trickster and crosses boundaries and can represent many different shapes. And I think it was a really, I was really pleased that we got to touch on that in this series.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
That's my absolute pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, Anthony, I know you have not heard my conversation yet with Tom Hiddleston, but our listeners just heard it. And I just want to let you know that a fly crashed our conversation. Like
a fly?
A fly. Like Tom Hiddleston noted it. He's like, there's a rather large fly here. And then he talked to the fly. That happened. And I left it in the edit because I thought it was funny.
Can you hear the fly?
You can't hear. I saw the fly because I was talking over Zoom. I couldn't hear it, but he was worried.
Are we sure it's not an Ant-Man situation where...
Or is it Mephisto? Is it a cicada? I don't know. Welcome back to Marvel Speculation Land.
It's the 17-year swarm.
First of two Mephisto references I will make here. Obviously, like
foreshadowing Chekhov's gun.
if you hadn't listened to us talk about WandaVision, I will say that something like that happened when we talked about WandaVision on this podcast many a month ago was that, you know, I got sort of amped up around theorizing. I'm not apologizing for it. And I'm not promising I won't do it this time because I think it's really fun. But I just hope that we all like remember, given what we've seen so far from the shows, that's going to inform how I speculate in terms of like, how big are we going to go? I don't know. You know, it's hard to say, but like, I'm probably not going to be like, well, and then the Fantastic Four are going to show up sort of thing. So that's, you know, 2 feet on the ground. There was a stained glass window of a devil in this episode that showed up in the trailer a long time ago and had people going Mephisto ? I don't think so, but you know, I just thought I'd flag it, lest we get an email at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com for not mentioning the devil in the window that we definitely saw. Anthony Breskin, welcome to Loki.
Welcome. I definitely think they're teasing the demonic and the devil and the Mephisto quite a bit for there not to be some eventual payoff.
Maybe. He also mentions a nightmare department, right, in this episode, and that was Nightmare was another sort of guess we had for WandaVision. So maybe it's all headed to some sort of hell dimension. We'll see. But right now, I think we gotta keep our eye on the prize, which is Loki. So let's talk about, I wanted to start by talking to you about, this thing that, before we get to my big bananas theory that I have already concocted, I regret to tell you, I'll save that for the end. So let me start here.
Big comma bananas or big bananas?
No oversized bananas. let's start with something that I did talk to Tom a little about, but I'm curious. What I think is interesting about the show is that it's doing for Loki what Thor Ragnarok did for Thor, which is remove all of his trapping, remove his magic, remove his costume that we're accustomed to, remove his daggers, remove Asgard's gone. Everyone, like, he's alone here in the show. He doesn't even have, like, a Vision or a Winter Soldier. It's just Loki, you know, alone in the show. And strip him down to find out who is Loki without all those things. Something I think that's really interesting is that I was listening to an old Taika Waititi interview where he was talking about how the prompt for Thor Ragnarok was strip Thor, you know, give us a new Thor, a new take on Thor, right? Because Chris Hemsworth was tired of playing Shakespeare. He wanted to do comedy. Yeah. And give us a new take on Hulk, which is, we get like quasi-intelligent Hulk in that, right? And they were like, don't touch Loki. The fans love Loki. Don't touch Loki. That's something that he said. Like, he was allowed to play with whatever characters he wanted. Don't touch Loki. Kill the Warriors 3. Do whatever you want. Don't touch Loki. And then this show is like giving Tom the same sort of opportunity that they gave Chris in Ragnarok. So what do you think of this opportunity for him?
I think it's a great opportunity. It also places Loki in the challenging position of not being special, which I think is his borrow phrase from another comics universe, his kryptonite. You know, the notion that he was like a frost giant spawn rather than an actual Asgardian god, like, that gets to him. And he is very sensitive to being an outsider. So the notion that he is not only an outsider in the world he inhabits, but kind of a fringe figure on the Loki spectrum, like, he keeps trying to assert that he's the Loki, the superior Loki. And when they start, pointing out to him, the twist of this first episode is, you're the person we're hunting.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, imagine Hannibal Lecter if he were to find out that, there's another Hannibal Lecter out there. Like, I'm not so unique and special.
Yeah.
That's a lot to wrestle with.
Well, I mean, that is sort of the thing with Silence of the Lambs or Mindhunter or even the end of Catch Me If You Can, right? It's like it takes this criminal mind to catch the criminal that we need, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Yeah, but that lack of specialness, like, that leads me into like exactly what I want to talk about next, which is this idea of Loki's name. I was noting that when he goes on trial here in front of Judge Renslayer, she keeps saying Loki Laufeyson, right? Because his biological father is Laufey, the frost giant, right? Mm-hmm. And that Odin took him as a wee foundling from the frost giants and raised him as his own. So I was curious. To me, it sort of sounded like, I don't really want to make this comparison. I'm going to make it, but please know that I'm making it like super lightly. I'm not saying that this is what's happening here, but it's like misnaming someone who's like trans, like using a dead name for someone, like calling him Laufeyson felt like an attack versus calling him something else. So I was curious, like, what he calls himself in the movie. And like, oftentimes he says Loki of Asgard, right? I am Loki of Asgard, burdened with glorious purpose. That's something he says here in this episode, something he says in the Avengers, stuff like that, right? It's Odin who called him Laufeyson when he was punishing him in the Dark World and banishing him to the prisons forever. He called him Laufeyson. And then in this one makes me sad. In Infinity War, right before he dies at the hands of Thanos, he says, I, Loki, Prince of Asgard, Odin's son, the rightful king of Jotunheim, god of mischief, do hereby pledge to you my undying fealty. He calls himself Odinson in that, you know, post Odin calling him his son, post everything that happens in Ragnarok, stuff like that. So to put him here, I know it's a different part in his timeline, but to call him Laufey's son, I thought that was such an interesting choice. I don't know. Am I thinking too much? Am I reading too much into it? What do you think?
I don't know about the dead name thing.
No. I mean, that's...
I know you didn't mean anything by that. But
I don't.
But I think it's like, I would say, if I'm picking up what you're trying to say, that it would be kind of like calling Sting Gordon.
Sure. That's better.
Right?
That's way better.
Hey, Gordy. You know, yeah. like people assume another identity and move forward in life. And like, if you were to be like, oh, you're not, you know, you're not some badass. You're just this dork that I used to know in middle school. Like, by calling him Loki Laufeyson, like, it just sounds like the kid down the street, you know, like not some trickster villain who has fractured time and space repeatedly and caused all this anguish. Like, so I think that's what you mean, right?
It's a way better example. I regret my earlier decision. But like, and there's a similar moment in, I don't know if you watched any of Halston, the like limited series that they did with Ewan McGregor, who played the designer Halston, who called himself Halston, but had like a really boring first name, and I don't remember what it is. And at the very end, like in an attempt to needle him, these like suits are calling him by his like Midwestern name and not calling him Halston, right?
No, I think, what you're talking about here is the notion that you grow up and you assert your own identity in some way. And that happens in a lot of different capacities,
mm-hmm.
in entertainment, in personal relationships, and just for ourselves, just saying, who am I? What do I want to be known as? What do I want to be called? And this is kind of like throwing it back in his face that this is actually who you are. You know, that doesn't matter how much time has passed, because to the TVA, what is time? Time is just a reel that they have stored on a shelf somewhere. So you're not like all that you've been through doesn't count. That's what I felt like that use of the name. Everything that, you know, defines who you are, still Loki Laufeyson.
And I was asking Tom sort of like what if there was like a moment from the films that he felt like was most core to Loki's identity, his understanding of the character. And to him, he said it was the scene in the first Thor film where in the treasure in Odin's vault, where he confronts Odin about his identity, and he says, "What am I?" You know, to Odin when he's trying. When that's when he finds out about Laufey's son is something that he says, right? But he says like, "What am I?" And then he says something like, "I'm the monster," and all this sort of stuff like that. So like that, this show is so much about Loki's identity. Also, that idea that like one of his most common phrases that he says is like, burdened with glorious purpose, something that he sort of scoffs at the end, by the end of this mm-hmm. episode, but like burdened with glorious purpose, like what an interesting cluster of ideas in those words there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is.
So
heavy is the head that wears the crown, especially exactly. Loki's crown, because it's two gigantic like tusks that stick true. Out it's 5 feet, so that is a heavy crown.
That's true. It's very true.
Literally.
All right. So you said, what is time to the TVA? Time is just a reel on a shelf. These are folks who can just like pop into time anytime they want and pull something out and maybe enjoy it. So Anthony Brezikin, what was your favorite little anachronistic artifact item that you saw in this episode?
Okay. So when I was watching it, I texted Joanna. And I'm like, he's drinking Jasta. Because, I noticed that they were just very, like, the cans that Mobius was drinking from were just very prominently placed on mm-hmm. the table. And I'm like, ooh, do they have brands in the TVA? It's outside space and time, but is it outside of branding? and then I was like, Jasta. I thought at first it was Shasta. I was like, oh, that's interesting. No, that's not Shasta. It's Jasta. I'm like, what was Jasta? And it turns out to be this like obscure soda from the 90s that was like only around for a couple of years. And I just, all of my synapses fired. I just loved the notion that one of the perks of being a drone an unperson in the TVA is that you can sample random crap from whenever, you know, that may be completely gone. Like, I expect at one point for them to all, like, kick back and take a break after work and throw back a Billy beer, you know? Like,
it's what about some Crystal Pepsi?
Or Crystal Pepsi. But Josta is like right up there with Crystal Pepsi, like the thing that existed once and had a big push and no longer does. And as we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I think, you know, objects, anachronistic objects become clues as the story progresses. And so Josta actually serves a purpose in addition to just being a funny little like 90s era Easter egg. But like, oh yeah, when you're hop skipping through time, you might leave a trail, and that trail might be, oh, this is something from a different time. Maybe we can go there and catch you.
Ooh, I like it. All right. Let us talk about the Kang of it all. We talked about this a little bit on our preview episode, this idea that like maybe we meet these, we don't meet them significantly. We are become aware of these three timekeepers. We see their stony visages all over the place in this
creepy
TVA.
Can you imagine having those three guys behind you in Gugu Mbatha Raw's office? Like, they're like, God, guys, back off. Talk about your boss. Imagine if our editors, we had like three statues of our editors behind us at all times.
Like that. Just Jeff, Katie, and Hillary looking over our shoulders. That'd be really funny. So in the comics, these timekeepers are known as Ast, Vort, Xanth, great future names, love that. They are not named here yet, and there might be a reason why.
Well, the guy in the middle looks like Kang the Conqueror.
That's what we kind of think. Maybe Kang the Conqueror is not one of the timekeepers in the comics, but that doesn't mean he's not one of the timekeepers here. And we should say that in that cartoon sort of exposition dump that we get from Miss Minutes, They show an animated version of the timekeepers, and there's one that has a blue face. It doesn't look like any of the timekeepers look in the comics. And so I think that one might be Kang the Conqueror. And the reason we say looks like is because we know the actor who's playing Kang the Conqueror in Ant-Man 3, which is Jonathan Majors. What do you
Fantastic.
Know?
And it kind of looks like his face, but it's hard to tell because, you know, sculpted sharp angle. Yeah, a lot of it's Art Deco, but I'm like, yeah, it kind of looks like him, you know.
It could be him.
And then when you see the animated thing and you see it looks a lot like Kang, I think so. And also, I think, as we know and we've said before, Marvel plays with the comic storytelling like that. The comic books are kind of its R&D lab, and then they take that and expand it or change it a little more. The Nexus, don't they describe the Nexus as like sort of, this is what happens if too many there, like the Nexus is when there are too many timelines.
When someone steps off the timeline of variant, they create a Nexus event, which if left unchecked could branch off into madness. Yeah.
And that's an important word too, since we have Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. So I think what we're going to see is this, that all of the good work of the hardworking individuals of the TVA is they're not going to be able to stop this branching of timeline. And if you're in the three timekeepers, now they were leaders of a civilization or civilizations that were at war with each other, right? So let's say Kang decides he's going to usurp this triumvirate and take the power for himself.
Maybe. I mean, it's interesting to wonder, and it does, Richard brought this up in the first half, but it does remind me a lot of Doctor Who. In Doctor Who, there's this like time war, and there are these time lords and all this sort of stuff like that. And they make a lot of rules about like what can happen in the time stream and stuff like that. So, putting Kang in there is sort of interesting and could provide some nice connective tissue as we roll forward to Ant-Man. We mentioned another reason. I mean, I don't know how many people listened to the preview episode, so I'm just going to repeat myself. We mentioned another connection is that in the comics, Kang is in love with a character named Ravonna Renslayer, which is the name of the character Gugu Mbatha Raw is playing. So that could be a connection going forward. Will we see Jonathan Majors in the show? I'm not ready to say that. Yes, but I'm not ready to say that. But maybe it could happen at the end, final episode. Who knows?
Well, that'll be cool. Now, is he going to turn up in Multiverse of Madness, the Doctor Strange movie, or just Ant-Man? I know there was casting announced.
He's confirmed for Ant-Man. He might be a Multiverse of Madness. I don't know. But Kang is this, like, time travel is a big thing for Kang. Big villain. He's shown up as a kid named Iron Lad. He's an interesting fella, Kang the Conqueror. And I'm really excited because, you know, I'm on record as being a huge Jonathan Majors fan, so I'm excited for all of that.
Same. Great. I mean, and like, I think what's so interesting about that is that I may have also said this in the previous episode, but I think of Jonathan Majors as like, he's caught just such like leading man charm and like heroic sensibilities. He's so great on screen. He has like, just in the same way that you like people like maybe Harrison Ford have it, right? Like, you're just like, you're so good looking and there's still something vulnerable and charming about you and you're such a good guy. And when Harrison Ford plays bad, like in Mosquito Coast or in something like What Lies Beneath, like, he hasn't done that a lot. Usually he's the hero. But seeing somebody who has that just sort of innate goodness surrounding them to play a villainous character is a really good combination. So I'm hoping that makes Kang very, very evil and despicable, but also very magnetic. So the more they tease this character, I think it sounds even better than it looks in the comics. Like, you look at him in the comics and you're kind of like, all right, Kang, are you angry because you never got out of your pajamas this morning? Or what is it? What's driving you? And as we've also said before, one of the great things about Marvel storytelling is that they know that the audience will care about a character who cares about someone else. So the fact that he has this relationship with Gugu's character, that, or if that's explored in the,
mm-hmm.
the TV show or in the movies, and let's say, you know, she's in peril or something happens to her, or she makes a choice that causes a fracture with him, that's a great ingredient for a villain, you know, a lost love or somebody betrayal, you know. So, you know, I think they've realized that you have strong characters when those characters care about other people, even if they're villains.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things one of my favorite notes that you've planted in my head that I'm always thinking about now. I think I can. I had a conversation with Jonathan about playing Kang. I have like a nice little chunky little conversation that we actually had to cut out of a Little Gold Men episode that came out a couple months ago because, you know, the powers that be at Marvel didn't want him talking about it at all. So I can't talk about what he said. That conversation will happen again in the future when everyone feels more comfortable talking about it. But I'm really, based on what he said and what prep he was doing, I'm very excited for what he's going to do with his character. So, the Kang of it all.
Insider trading.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned.
I hope I'm on the right track with that, but you'll have to tell
me. No, nothing you said makes me feel like you're on the wrong track, I guess. But he didn't give me any big plot details. It was just Marvel being, you know, overly cautious about not wanting a single thing to come out. Okay. Speaking of which, I had this like really dumb thought that I thought I'd share with you, which is that, you know how they talk, like it used to be when they talked about Marvel Studios, they would talk about Kevin Feige as the head of Marvel Studios. But more recently, I think as they've taken on this TV empire and stuff like that, they talk about it as a triumvirate of like Kevin Feige, Victoria Alonso, and Lou Desposito, those two have been there from the beginning along with Kevin. And they're sort of, I think they've been sort of elevated to this tribal council of three to handle the massive influx of work that they've given themselves by doing so much more than they used to do. And so I was like, oh, are the timekeepers kind of, you know, because they were like, once upon a time, there were all these conflicting continuities and the timekeepers put them together in one smooth, sacred timeline. And that's like, it reminds me of like all the various Marvel movies that used to be licensed out to various studios. And now they're just trying to harness it all back. Here come the Fantastic Four back in. Here comes Spider-Man. Here comes X-Men. We're going to wrangle it all into the sacred timeline. So I just thought I'd share that dumb thought that I had with you. Not, I don't think it's intentional. I just think it's funny in my own head.
Yeah, I think it's grounding, you know. It's important.
Especially
when you're talking about time. It's like, where's everybody else? this point. So yeah. It's like nice to have a little marker of like, oh, when you were doing this, I was doing that. So,
well, and it's interesting because this show takes place out of time, right? The TVA is an institution out of time, and they're hopping all around various points in the timeline. But like, if we're talking about Nexus events and we're talking about all this stuff, and we know that Nexus is a concept that showed up in WandaVision, like, and Loki was snapped out, I don't know, in the midst, it's out of time, but in a certain way, it also is kind of before WandaVision, because WandaVision was just a couple months after Endgame. It's mostly out of time, but if I had to place it on a board somewhere, actually, no, the pin would be off the board. Okay, never mind. Moving on.
No, but I think this, you bring up an interesting point.
Yeah.
You want to flee from it. That's okay. But, you know, one of the challenges I think they had is that so much of their storytelling was right on top of each other, but the movies themselves were spread out over a number of years. And I think they reached a point where they're like, all right, we've got to like fast forward 5 years. And that the snap kind of allowed them to do that, you know, just to catch up with the present day. Otherwise, we're going to be telling stories from 2015 and it's 2021. So sometimes you got to like hit the little glowing star from Mario Brothers and just go fast and go and, you know, and break out of that rigid timeline that's locked very tightly to our own, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, like you mentioned them being out of time,
mm-hmm.
and like outside of time. And it reminds me, there's a really good Elvis Costello song called Man Out of Time. And the opening lyrics are, so this is where he came to hide when he ran from you in a private detective's overcoat, dirty dead man's shoes. And I don't know how much of the rest of this song would correspond to it, but just that idea of like, this is where he came to hide.
Mm.
Kind of relates to the Loki that they're chasing. And that if you are committing atrocities, that this outside place is a good home base or a good place to hide out and lay low and plot your next move. Because you could do it as long as you want, because you're not aging, clock's not spinning forward, yet you're able to.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm plunging head over heels down my own rabbit hole here, but like,
listen, rabbit holes are encouraged on Still Watching Loki.
Yeah.
We live for the rabbit holes. To bring it back to like a timeline we can understand, mm-hmm. I think it's funny when Loki says, listen, it's been a long day, and you remember that this is the same day that the Hulk like tossed him around like a rag doll and called him a puny god. Like that's the same day for Loki. So it's been truly has been a long day. Okay, Anthony, if you're like me, you often think about what it meant for Steve Rogers to exit the time stream in Endgame and choose a happily ever after with Peggy. I think about this all the time and try to make it make sense. This is a mess left for Michael Waldron and his writers to clean up. So what does this description of a sacred timeline and branching realities and all this sort of stuff, how does it inform your understanding of what happened when Steve Rogers left the timeline to loop back and be with Peggy?
Yeah, I'm wondering about that because, like, is he a variant?
Right.
In that long ago time, it's been a long, long time, having that dance, like, are the TVA going to pop into his living room and set off one of their charges?
Prune him? I mean, that's my question. Is I rewatched this episode a couple times, and I don't think I have a satisfying answer because it feels like they don't prune all branches.
No, and they do have that line where he says, I don't know if this is the first or second episode. We've seen both, so I hope I'm not scrambling them. But there is a question of like, well, why aren't you going after the Avengers? They're the ones hopping around through time stealing.
That's in this episode, yeah.
Infinity Stones.
Yeah.
And I forget who it says. It's
Renslayer who says it. Yeah.
Yeah, like that was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
So if Steve is supposed to go back and start his life over with Peggy, then it's okay.
Right. But is that the sacred timeline? Did he run along the sacred timeline, or did he create a branch that was so non-threatening to the foundation of the sacred timeline that they were like, let him have it. Let him have that little twig of a life. And if so, if he created a branch, can Steve then hop from how does he get back to the lake with the shield for, like, can he hop branches? If anyone could do it, maybe Steve Rogers could, but I don't know the answer to that.
To stick with the metaphor of branching.
Okay.
You know, sometimes, I don't know if anybody out there is into horticulture, but like, you know, like how I'm not into it enough to know the technical terms for these things, but sometimes a branch, a tree trunk will like swallow a branch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of think what Steve did is that, yes, he went back and he branched, but then it kind of wove back into the sacred timeline too. Like,
so it's like a little loop, like a little,
just a little knot,
a little knot on the top of the sacred timeline. Anyway, if you guys have better ideas, also, we accept any charts and graphs. I'm a big fan of charts and graphs when it comes to time travel. You can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Your understanding of what this description of the time, sacred timeline and its many branches means to Steve Rogers.
I will say in 20 years of talking to writers and filmmakers and directors that the overriding rule when it comes to time travel is what do you need to happen?
Yeah.
And then, okay, now how do you create a rule that justifies it?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not here. We're not Stephen Hawking here. We're not accepting any algorithms or any kind of.
No, I mean, I'll take your algorithms. I may not read your algorithm on air, but I will take your algorithmic email. Please.
But like, you know, we're not trying to prove that this is actually possible, but just what's the logic?
Yeah.
Like, okay, if why does this get pruned but that doesn't?
Right.
And, you know, I think if they can get away with having to deal with Steve Rogers, they will. They'll avoid it. But if they have to deal with that, then I think we'll get an explanation at some point.
Sounds good.
It reminds me of, like, Thank You for Smoking when Rob Lowe is trying to convince Aaron Eckhart that, like, we should put smoking in the space movie. He's like, but is it okay to smoke in outer space? And he's like, yeah, we'll just add a line. You know, thank God we invented the whatever device. Like, that's kind of the approach to time travel that writers and directors have to take. You know, thank goodness we invented the whatever device that allows that to be okay.
But
it's sort of like along the lines of a wizard did it, right?
A wizard did it. I'll give Waldron and his writers this credit, though, is that they were like in creating this world where there's a sacred timeline and there are timekeepers that decide what belongs on the sacred timeline and what doesn't. They interject in this episode and probably in many episodes going forward, this idea of free will and determinism. Like, then are all of our decisions pre-planned for us? Like, what's going on here? Loki's asking about approval or disapproval from the timekeepers. And Mobius says, don't think of it that way. But, like, how else are we supposed to think about it? And again, you know, Loki isn't quite himself able to make this connection, but the connection is there for the audience to make, where he talks about, when he talks about wanting to rule and wanting to conquer, and he says, what does he say? The first and most oppressive lie was the song of freedom. Choice brings shame and uncertainty and regret to nearly every living thing. Like, he would have made it easy for his subjects by removing choice from them, but he believes he, Loki, god of mischief, is exempt from that control, and to find out that he is in turn having his life dictated by these three space lizards, as he calls them, is an interesting thing for Loki to have to grapple with. You know?
Why does he call them space lizards? Because they didn't look very lizard-like.
A couple of them did. There's some green scaliness happening. Not on Kang, he's blue, but, like, you know, there's some green scaliness happening.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. The question is, and I have this question, you know, I've been doing this podcast about the TV show Lost, and there's a time travel season of Lost, which I love, but this phrase that they say a lot in the time travel season of Lost is whatever happened, happened. And my question around that was always, like, does that uninterestingly remove agency from our characters if whatever happened, happened is the answer to not, you know, fucking up the continuity of the timeline here. And, you know, because in Back to the Future, you know, if you do something, you wake up and maybe, you know, your dad's a best-selling sci-fi writer. You know what I mean? It's not whatever happened in Back to the Future. but, and it's not whatever happened here, but it's like, if what you do is steps on the butterfly that would change the language, you're going to get pruned. You know what I mean? It's, they're trying to have it, it feels like trying to have it both ways, you know?
It is. It's kind of a mind bender, because I think that's where the term branching comes from, is that you're not replacing, you're not changing, you're just breaking off or taking a left turn or a right turn.
Right.
And so whatever happened happened is continuing in that other timeline, but now other happenings are happening in this current one we are. The question is, what's happening and what's happening now?
Yeah, and it's so interesting, because in that little cartoon, that little like Mr. DNA from Jurassic Park cartoon that we get with Miss Minutes here.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because they even have the same kind of southern twang.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure what the accent is, but like folksy.
Yeah. Dano DNA. Yeah, it's did you see that in the credits, that's Tara Strong, the great voice actress Tara Strong doing Miss Minutes? Anyway, yeah, definitely an overt Dino DNA moment happening here, Mr. DNA. But in her narration there, you know, she says, long ago, countless timelines battled. Like, long ago, what does long ago mean to an agency out of time? That's my, like, what is, when is long ago? And so, and the reason I ask that question is not to be nitpicky, but to ask, when she says long ago, countless timelines battled each other for supremacy, nearly resulting in the total destruction of, well, everything, is that actually the future? And is that the multiverse of madness? Do you know what I mean? Like, is the thing she's describing actually the MCU's future?
That's another mind bender. I didn't take it that way. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying
I'm not saying I'm right. I'm saying
I interpreted it as whatever was pre Big Bang, and then the Big Bang was like, okay, now we're on one timeline. Like, we're that's like unification time. So I took it as when they said long ago, that like basically,
but you're saying long
time,
ago, you know, from 2021, but like, what's long, who programmed Miss Minutes, and when was long ago for this creation of this cartoon? Do you
good
know
question? I don't
know. Yeah, so I don't know if what we saw in that preamble was the multiverse of madness or the Quantumania of Ant-Man 3 or something like that. Do you know? I don't know. So, but it seems like a possibility. They use the word madness you know, intentionally, I think, to get us thinking about that sort of stuff. All right. Do you have anything else you want to talk about before I get to my big theory that you're going to like tell me is wrong?
No, I do want to say, and I brought this up in the last episode too, more than ever, I'm reminded of Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks film, right down to the way Mobius sort of conducts himself in casual, what we would consider just normal human behaviors, like eating, and hanging out. Like, Rip Torn played like the lawyer for Albert Brooks's soul in that movie. And the whole thing is like examining your whole life. And it has a very bureaucratic feel to it. You know, just buy the book. We're going to put on the reel. We're going to look at your life. This is what's happened. And yet, like, one time Rip Torn is eating this very strange looking meal, and Albert Brooks is like, oh, I'd like to try that. And then he has like, oh, you wouldn't like this. And then it turns out like he's on such a higher plane that he can enjoy things on a different level. And things that like younger souls or less experienced souls like can't do. And it just kind of struck me that way. That this movie and that movie and this show seem to have a lot of Dino DNA that they share. And what I find most interesting about it now, this isn't really a theory, but just more of a thematic thing, is that this is your life for Loki. I know I brought up Elvis Costello, but I'm going to go back to another like 70s era rockers. Although I think this was from the 80s. Pink Floyd had an album called The Final Cut. And there's a song on there that goes, they flutter behind you, your possible path. Some bright-eyed and crazy, some frightened and lost. And I think this is a chance for Loki to have a, you know, not just a this is your life moment, but like, this this was your lives. Like, this was all the possibilities for how things could have gone for you. And you are, in this particular thread of them, you know, you inhabit this version of Loki. And I think ultimately it's going to make him see that he is special, that he is different. There is something about him that's not, he's not good and he's not bad, but he's been pretty bad. So I'm really interested in the notion of a character reckoning with his possible past, who he could have been, who he could have, how things could have gone way worse or even way better for him, and yet finding some sort of homeostasis in there, like finding some peace and equanimity in the notion of who you are. So that's right. What I'm really interested in. I know that sounds really lofty.
But, no, not at all. No. I think it's exactly the premise of the show. I don't think it sounds lofty at all. This is the show. And like the fact that, you know, we talked about this in our preview episode, but like the fact that the comic that Waldron was most interested in was this Kid Loki Journey into Mystery comic. Mm-hmm. That wasn't not because there's a literal Kid Loki in the show, that there may be, but that's a reincarnation of Loki, and that's a Loki asking himself, who am I? Can I be good? Can I be trustworthy? And I think the answer that he finds is that there's like, it's sort of similar to like what we see in Infinity War, which is like Loki trying to use his, you know, he's barely in Infinity War, right? But like in his few moments of Infinity War, he's using his skill with deception for good, is what he's trying to do, what he fails to do, but what he's trying to do, mm-hmm. right? Where he goes up and he's like, oh, mighty Thanos, my undying loyalty. Meanwhile, the dagger materializes in his hand and he tries to go for the kill, right? So that's not Loki being like an angel. That's Loki being like, I'm the god of lies, I'm the god of mischief, but I'm mm-hmm. going to do this to try to save my people, save my brother, save every, you know, like all this sort of stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I just think it's just an interesting idea, yeah. a little philosophical thing. And I think people in general do this. My wife and I do it all the time. Like, what if I hadn't met you at that party when we were 18? Mm-hmm. Like, what if I'd skipped that? Like, how would one incident have changed everything for me? And I think almost everybody could, if you actually think back to your life, there really are dramatic turning points that you don't always see at the time, but later look back and go, oh my God, if I had gone to this school instead of that school, I would have been a very different person. Or if I, you know, hadn't met this one person or hadn't had this one teacher, your whole life can be diverted by one instant. And I find that really curious. And I think time travel is an interesting way, and multi-dimensions is an interesting way to explore this very real human thing. I mean, are there multiverses? I don't know. We'll have to wait for our listeners' algorithms to decide for sure. But I think there's definitely choices to be made.
Yeah.
And I think this is a show that's about choices.
And I mean, and that's something that Waldron said as well, right? Is that that's the advantage of a time travel story, is you can meet yourself on a timeline, or, you know, he used the case of Back to the Future, mm-hmm. Marty meeting his parents, right? But like, and Marty meeting his parents helps him understand himself better. So like, right. But in the case of Loki, because especially in the comics, canonically, there are multiple kinds of Lokis, Loki can meet versions of himself, and that could help him understand who this variant of Loki really is, you know?
Yeah. But we meet ourselves all the time in memory. If you think about our memories, they're the TVA.
Listen, right? If we're evolved, we meet ourselves all the time in memory. Some of us choose to lock those things away and not confront them. But I think that's what, like,
some of it's hard to face.
Yeah, right?
But our memories are like the TVA. Like it's like you've got this. It might be faulty. It might be a damaged reel. But like you do have this record in your own head of everything you've ever gone through. And I think one of the things that I've noticed about getting older, I'm in my early 40s, is you get a bit of, like, times change and you change. Not just, like, when you're 20, yeah, you change a lot because you've doubled in size, like, from over 10 years and you've, you know, had new experiences and new freedoms thrust upon you. And yet, I think when you live double that time, you go, oh, wow, I really am, like, different. I believe different things. I say different things. I have different friends. I look different. I think, you know, reckoning with your past and who you are and trying to be better or trying to bury that and not confront it at all, that's a choice too, right? That's the TVA, right? You can go harvest your file and at any time. It's right there. You know, beware.
It's harvesting your file is like, it's like, that's how I'm, that's my new way of telling people to go to therapy. Go harvest your file. Go to therapy. Go
just
spend
put it back
time.
In the right spot because you don't want to lose that.
Go spend some time in Time Theater number 5 and really go back over that file and see how you feel. All right, this brings us to my wild theory here. So this idea that, like, okay, in the first moments of the episode, we are taken to the endgame moment, the Avengers endgame moment, where, I mean, it's an Avengers movie, but also Avengers Endgame moment where Loki steps out of the timeline, right? 2012's Avengers, Battle of New York, etc. And we have this moment where Loki turns into Steve Rogers to imitate Steve Rogers, right? So we mm-hmm. know that, like, illusion, magic, shape-shifting, these are the hallmarks of Loki's magic, right? Is, like, shape-shifting and illusion, stuff like that. That being there not only helps us, those people who can't remember Endgame that well, or maybe didn't watch it, understand where Loki hopped out of the timeline. But, like, seeing him turn to Steve Rogers has me on high alert to be like, are they going to try to smuggle a Loki in that we don't know is a Loki? Do you know what I mean? If we're dealing with multiple Loki.
There's a Loki in the timeline.
There's a Loki in the show that we don't know is a Loki. Question mark. My main candidate right now is Owen Wilson. A secret Loki? That's the question I want to ask. Is Mobius actually a Loki? Some things that Tom Hiddleston said to me in that interview sort of got my gears turning on that, because he was talking about Mobius and Loki as sort of mirroring each other. You know, because, like, what Waldron said about Catch Me If You Can made me think of, like, Mobius in the Tom Hanks role and Loki in the Leonardo DiCaprio role, and that seemed pretty natural to me. And that, to me, feels like a paternal sort of avuncular is, of course, the very erudite British word that Tom Hiddleston used, but, like, a paternal or avuncular sort of figure, right? But, like, then he went on to talk about it, and he was talking a little bit more. You know, there's that moment where Loki says, you know, I'm smart, and Mobius says, I know you are. And that moment just stops me dead every time, because on the one hand, it sort of feels like everything you want to hear from a father figure, right? Like, you've been desperate for approval your whole life, and you finally here's a slightly older than you, not that much older than you, man saying to you, I know you're smart. Like, of course you are. Like, you don't have to prove that to me. I know. And so that, there's that angle of it. But what if it's just sort of like, yeah, as another Loki, I know you're smart. You're Loki. So of course you're smart. I'm Loki too. I get it. You know what I mean? Once again, question mark. I don't know.
He also knows when he's BSing.
Uh-huh. And so, okay. And so, And so Loki's like, I forget what he says to inspire this, but Mobius says, even when you're wooing someone powerful you intend to betray, is something he says about Loki's demeanor, which made me think of this line that Mobius has when he's talking to Judge Renslayer in the courtroom, when he goes, I feel like I'm always looking up to you. I like it. It's appropriate. And it's given this, like, beautiful Owen Wilson delivery. It's funny. It's sort of Owen Wilson-y, blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, isn't that just exactly the kind of, like, unctuous, suck-up-y thing that Loki might say to someone he's trying to manipulate? Like, isn't it? So in terms of, like, clues, timeline clues, like, why is Mobius so interested in Josta Soda? Is this a Loki who stepped out of 1990 or something like that? Like, when was Josta Soda popular? I don't know.
Well,
but, like, is this...
he reveals another obsession in a second episode, which I guess we'll get into.
Yeah, I can't talk about that yet, but that's,
but
what I'm thinking about. Yeah.
I will say he has a very Little Mermaid style fascination with objects from the world they're not a part of,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he's not really twirling his hair with a fork or calling something a flugelhorn, but like, I think there's just an interesting, what's interesting is that objects in our world that have very little value have a lot of value to people in the TVA, and objects here that are, you know, beyond priceless, like Infinity Stones, are just stuff in a junk drawer, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and, yeah, they're marbles. Exactly.
And I think there's a metaphor in that, too, if we're going to get deep and melancholy. like it's sort of like when I look back, when I look into the box I have of things that are precious to me, like, you could break into my house and steal it. It is worth absolutely nothing to you. Like, it's literally just like, it would look like a box of junk. But each thing in there has a little piece of memory for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, maybe these are little bits of memories or happy experiences that they carry with them. And that those things are precious, but Infinity Stones or priceless gems or money, things like that, you know, they just don't mean as much when you get right down to it. So anyway.
No, it's true. It's true, and it's a really interesting reorienting of what's powerful. I talked to Richard about this a little bit, but like, well, you know, Waldron said something about like, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Thanos? Like, how do you make a Marvel struggle feel big after Infinity War? And it's make the Infinity Stones small. That's how you do it. You know what I mean?
That's, so here's a yeah. Oh,
no, go ahead.
All right, so I just thought of something. Potentially stupid.
that's our tagline. The tagline of the TVA is for all time always. Our tagline here at Still Watching Loki is potentially something stupid. Let's hear it.
I have to start with a little personal anecdote. I'll make it fast.
Okay.
But like, so I'm from, as some people know, I talk about it a lot. I'm from Pittsburgh. Pittsburghers are very proud of their town. And, you know, I've lived away from there for much longer now than I live there, so that tether is getting longer and longer. And a few years ago, I took a trip back, and there's a store, like a grocery store called Giant Eagle there, and they make these thumbprint cookies. And in the 80s and 90s, when I was a kid, they gave kids little credit cards, like things that looked like credit cards, so that you could go shopping with your mom or dad and go to the bakery and present this card, and they would give you one of these cookies.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I love it.
And it was like, awesome. It was the best thing in the world. And I had been away for a few years, and I went back, and I was at the grocery store, you know, and I found these chocolate thumbprint cookies with walnuts sprinkled on top. I bought them, and just the smell of them, just the taste of them, like was time travel back to a younger time. And then every time I would visit for a friend's wedding or for a funeral or, you know, whatever the event was, I would like stock up on these things and bring them back with me and then like try to save them for, they'd last a few months. I could put them in the freezer. What if Josta soda is, you know, it's tied in a temporal way to the 90s. What other Marvel property is set in the 90s, but Captain Marvel?
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, could there be a Marvel, Captain Marvel element, like with Mobius, that going to that story in that time and place, could that become a factor?
Could
that become meaningful? And is the Josta soda like the chocolate thumbprint cookies that are like that's what he picks up when he's there? You know, like
that's what I think. Like I think it has to be some sort of exactly what you mean, like chocolate thumbprint cookie, like. I live a little closer to the bakery where I grew up. I live at, like about an hour and a half away. And if I'm ever over there, I will. Yeah, I'll grab it. They're called ice cream cookies. And I'll grab a little ice cream cookie. And it just like tastes like, you know, no other cookie tastes like your childhood, like that cookie. You know what I mean? So it is that thing. And so I'm just wondering, like, is it a fun little Easter egg, like, you know, an Apollo bar sort of like thing that the soda is here? Or is it actually tied to something like that Mobius ties Mobius to the 90s? I don't know.
Yeah, we'll talk about this a little more in the next episode because he reveals another obsession and he does say it's from the 90s. So.
I'm just saying. And to put a button on all of that, like I said, we're going to try to theorize responsibly this time. So I was trying to think, when I got excited about this, I was like, okay, think this through, Robinson. Don't get yourself twisted. All right. So let's think about this. The last two Marvel shows have had a villain hiding in plain sight in Agatha and WandaVision and Sharon in Falcon and the Winter Soldier, right? So like, are they going 3 for 3, or have they done it twice and they're not going to do it a third time? That's a question. Also, the last two shows had female villains, something that Marvel is sort of like making up for lost time, being like, see, women can be evil too.
How progressive.
real
see,
feminism.
We can say women are evil. Yeah. Okay.
So are they going to want to try to make the villain a dude this time? Instead? Like, because my idea is like,
Are we asking questions that we already know the answers to?
No, I'm not. I'm genuinely not. I think that, this isn't episode 2 spoilers. This is, like, genuinely, like, is...
Who's the ultimate villain?
Who's the villain here? If Mobius is a hidden Loki, if he is, what is he doing there? What's his goal? Like, if the Time Variance Authority is because he was interrogating our Loki, our Tom Hiddleston Loki, Loki Lifeson, about what do you want? What do you want from there? You want to rule? You want to rule all space? What do you want to do? What are you doing? Where are you running, Loki? What are you doing? What's your goal? And if the Infinity Stones are marbles to the TVA, isn't that a lofty aim for a Loki to take control of the TVA, to be in control of all of time? I don't know.
Bigger than Infinity Stone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Also, the name Mobius, we talked about this in the previous episode. You know, the Mobius strip is a single object with two sides.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm describing that badly. It's an object with only one side, but appears to have two. It's twisted. So, you know, it's one continuous, it's one continuity. And so is that what Mobius and our Prime, well, let's call him Loki Prime,
sure.
Right? Like,
he has a number. I did write it down, but I like calling him Loki Prime.
I'm stealing that from the show Counterpart, which was another great alternate dimension show.
He's L1130. That's his technical term, but I like Prime. We can call him Loki Prime. He's our Loki Prime, the Prime of our hearts. Yeah. If you still watching pod at gmail.com, if you have any number theories around 1130, he says this thing. When Mobius sort of zips Loki back into his chair and he says, back in your cage, right? And then he says, I can play the heavy keys too. And I was like, and that's what he said. I rewound it so many times. We don't get closed captioning on our screener, so I didn't watch with closed captioning, but I rewound it a bunch of times to make sure that's what he said.
He did. Yeah, I remember that.
But I was like, that's not a phrase I know. Like, I Googled it. I was like, is this like a piano thing? Like, I can play the heavy keys. Like, I can play the heavy, which is the villain, right? The heavy keys. I don't know what that means. And I was like, did he say heavy Loki? No, he said heavy keys too. So I don't know if that's some sort of like, I don't know. I'm stuck on it. I'm the villain. I'm the heavy Loki. I don't know. Question mark.
I interpreted that as I can be dramatic too, like, because Loki was being very capital letters.
Totally.
But that phrase did stand out to me. I'm glad you mentioned it, because I was like, oh, that just must be an idiom that I don't know.
That's what I thought, and I Googled it, and I didn't find anything. And if you guys...
There is nothing. You're right.
Yeah.
Play the heavy keys. I can play the heavy keys too.
Yeah. Interesting. So anyway... Maybe it's a 90s phrase that has gone out of style. I don't know.
Do you remember that New York Times thing where they called the record company in Seattle to find out about new slang, and some person who answered the phone, like an operator, just said, oh, I can tell you all that. And then she proceeded to just make up a bunch of terms. And the New York Times ran it. It's like, this is what the kids are saying.
Like, for grunge slang or something like that?
Yeah. That's amazing. It was like, harsh realm means this. And, you know,
oh, she's a hero.
All of it was fabricated.
Hero, love that. All right. Well, I mean, I'm gonna be sticking fast to this theory for a little while. I'll tell you that much right now. Anthony Brezkin, anything else you want to talk about in terms of Loki episode 1? Until next week.
I think that covers it.
All right, we did it. We got melancholy. We got potentially stupid. We went down rabbit holes. What more could you ask for in a podcast?
We got thumbprint cookies. We've got a little bit of cicada talk.
Oh, I love cicada talk.
In there. We got it all.
All right.
We cover a lot of ground here. This was a good therapy session, Joe. Thank you. I'm sorry, our time's up.
No, you're welcome, but our hour is up. So you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns. Anthony Breskin, where can folks find you until we're back?
I'm writing at vanityfair.com and updating my blog at chocolatethumbprintcookies.net.
I hope you get, like, someone sends you a shipment of those cookies.
I have epic stories of trying to steal the recipe through bribery and misrepresentation. I've done the whole Loki trickster thing to get that recipe. So,
Anthony, are you a Bresnikan or a Bresnikant? Get that recipe, man.
I could not get it. One time I called and I was like, oh, you know, my son ate these and is having a bad reaction. What is the I know the ingredients are on the package, but what are the proportions? And they wouldn't tell me.
Oh my God, it's the funniest thing
this
I've
ever
heard.
This is after trying to buy them for $50 from a bakery employee. And she was like, the recipe we have will make 1,000 cookies. I'm like, I can do division. Just give it to me.
Oh my God, that's so funny. I do have, actually, I worked at a bakery that, like, a bakery near where I grew up in high school, and they closed. And so they let me take all the recipes. You know, it wasn't stealing. They let me take all the recipes, but they are all in massive quantities, and I've never properly converted them. So
it's like a truckload of flour. Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I guess I don't know how to divide that.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me on Vanity Fair alongside Anthony. And also you can find Richard on Twitter at Rylaws and also on Vanity Fair. And we will be back with more thoughts and theories and therapy sessions next week. Bye.
Bye.
This variant is insubordinate, stubborn, unpredictable.
You name the god of mischief.
Wherever you go, it's just death, destruction, the literal ends of worlds.
Okay. Change. Change.
Maybe Loki wants to mix it up. Is that possible? He can change.
I am Loki, and I am burdened with glorious purpose.
Change.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
From PRX.